Well, Rabbi Momri, or Rabbi Soloveitchik, Stern.
Let me reintroduce myself. My name is Yonah. I am a rabbi and a teacher. I am a poor rabbi and a very good teacher. That I am a good teacher, I can demonstrate by pointing at Rabbi Rizki. He was my pupil, my student. I took pride in him and came here actually to help him out attain a goal about which he dreamt a long time. Now let me ask you a question. Do you want a long drosha or a short one? But before you say, I want to define. Short means 2 hours at least. Long is until dawn. By sheer association, I recall now an experience of my early youth. Let me give you the background of that experience. I was then about 8 or 7 years old. I attended, it was in a small town in Russia, White Russia, on the border of White Russia and Russia proper. The town was called Khaslavich. You certainly have never heard the name. My father was rabbi in the town. I, like any other Jewish boy, attended the cheder. My teacher was not a great scholar, but he was a chassid, a chabadnik, whose expertise in the study and the teaching of Gemara was then under a question mark. I, as a young boy, questioned his scholarship. Now I know, I don't have to question. I stopped doubting. I'm sure that it was a poor Gemara on it. However, I've been grateful to him for all my life, because he taught me something which no one else, perhaps there is one exception, my mother. He taught me something which no one else taught me. Mainly, he taught me he didn't train my mind, but somehow he addressed himself to my soul, to my heart. He taught me how a Jew can be imaginative in religious matters. Imagination in religious matters, in practicing Judaism. Many people practice Judaism, but they lack imagination, they lack sleep. Like that, he taught me how to practice Judaism, Torah and mitzvahs, in an imaginative way. How to see, I would rather say, how to behold the vision. Not many cheder boys knew what a vision is, and not many knew how to behold a vision. Could you give me the lamp now? Okay. He taught me how to dream and how to experience Yahados. How to feel Yahados. How to live Yahados. Not just to practice, but to live Yahadus. the experience, I mean the episodes which I'm about to relate to you, took place on a murky winter day, about in January. I still remember the day. It was a cloudy day. It was in after the Hanukkah festival had passed. It was partially Yiddish. And with the Hanukkah festival, somehow passed the little solemnity and the little, what shall I say, I have to use your Yiddish word, Yontivdikait, which this festival has brought into the monotonous and listless lives of the poor Jews, most of them of our peddlers, in that small town on the river Soj, as to remember the name of the river. As far as we were concerned, boys from the cheder, a long, long winter lay ahead. It was a winter when we had to get up while it was still dark, and we returned home from the cheder with a lantern in the hand of each boy, because it was dark in the streets. And that day, that particular day, the whole cheder, all the boys who were in a depressing mood, listless, lazy, and sad, we recited, or I would rather say chanted, mechanically, the first psukim of Parsha Vayigash, in a dull monotone. We were simply drawing the words in Hebrew as well as in the Jewish vernacular. And so we kept on reading mechanically, Vayigash Hashem of Yehuda, Vayimah Bi Adini, and then Yehuda came near unto him and said, Oh my master, Yidabo Me'avdecho, Dobo Bozne Adini, let thy servant, I pray thee, speak a word in my master's ear, Vayichar Apcho Adini, let not thy anger burn against thy servants. And Adini Shoal is Avod of Lomer, and my master asks his servants, Ayesh Lachem Orov, Eyoch, have you a father or a brother? Vanemar Adini Yesh Lanu Ov Zokin, V'yomet Skumim Koton. And he said unto my master, we have a father, an old man, and a child. And I permit myself to use the interpretation of the Targum Yerushalmi. Skuni was mean, was born when my father was old. But Yonet Skuni means a talented boy, a talented child, a capable, talented, bright child. We have an old father, and we also have a talented child, a little one. And then, the boy who read it mechanically, finished reading the question and the reply, Ayesh Lachem Rov, Eloch, and the reply, Yesh Lanu Ov Zokin, the Yoletz Kurim, the Rebbe, the Melamed. Something strange happened. The Melamed, who was half asleep, while the boy was droning on the words in Yiddish and in Hebrew, rose, jumped to his feet, like a lion, like a tiger. He leaped to his feet, like a tiger. With a strange, enigmatic gleam in his eye. He usually had velvety blue eyes, but suddenly His eyes were pierced, became piercing, and someone investigating eyes, searching eyes. He motioned to the reader, to the boy who read, to stop reading, turned to me, and said, and he used the words, Pod Ravin, it means assistant to the rabbi. Whenever he was excited, he used to address himself to me with this title, assistant to the rabbi. There was a tinge of sarcasm and cynicism in his in using this term, because General Ahmed Chabadnik could never forgive me the crime, that I was born into the Brisk house, which represented misnagdes at the highest level. I mean, I must say, I cannot accept responsibility for that. And he said to me, what kind of question did Joseph ask his brothers? Do you have a father? Of course they have a father. Everybody has a father. The only person, I remember he had it, the only person who had no father was a revolution. But Kol Bo Elam, whoever is born into this world, I mean, has a father. What kind of a question is it? I answered, Joseph, I tried to answer, I didn't get me. Joseph meant to find out whether the father was still alive. Yesh lechem och, do you still have a father? It means he's alive, not dead. In such a case, Sadam Alamed thundered back at me. He should have phrased this question differently. Ha'id avichem chai. I mean, to argue with him was useless. And he began to talk. He did not address himself to us, to the boys anymore. The impression he gave was as if he had been speaking with some mysterious visitor, a guest, who came in into the cheder, into that room. And he kept on talking. Joseph did not intend to ask his brother about what he called it that time. It is, then later I discovered it is a Chabad term, Avus Disgalian, parenthood or fatherhood, which is open, visible. But about Avus Disgalian, about the mysterious fatherhood or parenthood, the hidden parenthood, invisible fatherhood. A mother idiom between you and me, a mother idiom, I would say he meant to express the thought that Joseph inquired about existential parenthood, not biological parenthood. Joseph, the Melamed continued, this father was anxious to know whether they feel themselves committed to the makor, to the origin. Whether they are origin conscious. Many people are not origin conscious. He wanted to find out whether the origin comes here. Are you, Joseph, as the brothers, rooted in your father? Do you look upon him the way the branches or the blossoms look upon the roots of the tree? Do you look upon your father as the feeder, as the foundation of your existence? look upon him as if he were as a provider and sustainer of your existence? Or are you a band of ruthless shepherds who forget their mocker, their origin, and travel and wander from place to place, from pasture to pasture? Are you, he suddenly stopped addressing himself to the strange invisible visitor and began to talk to us, raising his voice. Are you modest and humble? Do you admit that the Old Father represents an old tradition? Do you believe that the Father is capable of telling you something new, something exciting, something challenging, something you didn't know before? Or are you insolent, arrogant, and vain, and you deny your dependence upon your Father, upon your Makor? Ayesh lochemoch, exclaimed the Melamed, pointing at my study mate. I had a study mate. That time in the town they said that he is the new prodigy. He was stupid, I'm between you and me. But anyway, I had the reputation of a prodigy. I had the reputation of a slow child, he had the reputation of a prodigy. So he turned, it was called Itzildem Schmidt. I mean, his father was a blacksmith. Well, what do you say, Itzik? The human, the prodigy, it was very hard to find out what I meant. See, he was serious about it, he was sarcastic. What do you say, Itzik, the prodigy? Who knows more? Itzik? Because he knows 150 blood gemara by heart? But that's what I legend. He didn't know a single page by heart. 150 pages of Gemara Behar, or his father, Rabbi Yaakov the Shmid, Jacob the blacksmith, who can hardly read Hebrew, who can hardly daven. Who is it? Are you proud, Itzik, or are you even humble? Are you Shlachov, or you have no father? And then he ended in a whisper, if a Jew admits the supremacy of his father, right here, ergo facto, he recognizes also the supremacy of the universal father, who is very, very, very old, Atik Yemin. The Almighty is called Atik Yemin, old in years. Me'ilom vadenu. This is the experience I have. I've never forgotten it. Employing this approach, you may say it was a symbolic interpretation of the question, but it was a nice approach. Employing this approach to Joseph's inquiry, the way that my Muhammad did, we may also interpret the second question, not Ayesh Lachem Ov, but Eoch, Ayesh Lachem Ov, Eoch. Do you have a brother? In the same manner in which the Melamed interpreted the first question, Ayesh Lachem Ov. Yesh Lachem Ov, he was not interested whether you have a brother or not, a biological brother who inherited the identical genetic code from their parents. I mean, it's completely irrelevant, Mr. Joseph, according to my Melamed. Joseph wanted to know, does your time awareness encompasses just the present or the future as well? Does your time awareness or your existential awareness, we do exist, we exist, I exist, you exist, we exist. Does this awareness embraces just me and my friends, my parents, my children, This awareness, I exist awareness, embraces generations unborn yet. Oh, do you plan not for the world of today? It's too late to plan for the world of today. Do you plan for the world of tomorrow? It's still time to plan for this world, which for the world of tomorrow, which is enveloped in the mist of non-being. Do you behold a vision here? Do you believe in the improbable, that the improbable might happen? Do you believe in the fantastic, that the fantasy may turn into reality sometimes? Do you believe that the future can be... Yes, no, no, it's okay. The yell is clear. Yes, Master. We do have a very old father in whom we feel that we all are deeply rooted. And by being rooted in him, we feel as if we were rooted in eternity and in infinity. In the oldest of all fathers, in the Atikyome. The Yeret Skunim Koton. Yes, Master, we also have a wonderful, young, talented, bright child, a shining eye. Vicious, pleasant, representing the world of tomorrow. We have the feeling, when we take a look, when we glance at the child, at the baby, as if he, this little child, is challenging us to make the birth of generations unborn yet possible, and to help non-being emerge as something real. Yes, we have it. Let me add something. The answer the sons of Jacob gave to Joseph holds still true even today. It's a true answer. And I'm not a chauvinist, I'm very far. Of course, I believe in Atta Bechartano, that we are unique, singular people. God elected us, but instead of giving us privileges, he burdened us with many duties. But I know also that we are sinners, we have many faults. So it's not because I just want to praise the Jew. But what the brothers of Jacob told him that on that day, Yeshlanu Ovzokim v'yeletz konim, is true. The Jew is a funny being. He is a funny creature, if I may use the word. We indeed have an old father. We indeed have an old father. He is part of our existential awareness. Until this day, we are committed to a great mysterious past in a very peculiar way. We are, if I may use this adjective, a funny people. Sometimes it's comical. It borders on the comical. We had, for instance, an edifice. Just a physical edifice. A massive edifice. We called it a Beis HaMikdash, sanctuary, magnificent one, beautiful one. This edifice, this physical structure, was just a physical structure. It consisted just of mortar and bricks. This edifice was consumed by fire about 1900 years ago. We still mourn, pretty soon we'll enter the 3 weeks 29 days in Tisha B'Av, we still mourn the destruction of that edifice, as if the fire, the tragic fire, had occurred just yesterday afternoon. We lived in a land many, many, many years ago. We still remember it. We haven't forgotten the land. This land. We still fight for the possession of this land. And we are still ready to sacrifice young lives, and we do sacrifice young. We do sacrifice young lives for each sand dune in that land, for each rocky hill, and for each shade-casting tree. Why? Why shouldn't an American Jew be concerned with Eretz Yisrael? He enjoys everything here. He's free, I mean. He has all the privileges. All gates are open for him. And anti-Semitism is a very far-fetched threat. We exaggerate and we are... It's completely ridiculous to speak about it. As much as we can judge. Why are we concerned with Eretz Yisrael? Committed to it. Why do we raise fabulous amounts of money to support those who fight and sacrifice their lives? What happened? Is there an explanation? Because we expect to be richer in Eretz Yisrael? We expect to enjoy more freedom in Eretz Yisrael? We expect to accomplish things in Eretz Yisrael in science, which we couldn't do it in America? No, it's not true, you know that's not true. Because, and this is a simple answer, it's a paradoxical answer, because approximately 3,500 years ago, our Rav Zocher, we had an old father, his name was Abraham, an old father, very old. That Rav Zocher walked behind his flock along those sandy trails and rocky hills. And somehow, by his walking, he endowed the land with his Gdusha, with his sanctity. That's what we think. Because centuries later, a king poet, prophet, his name was David, used to play the harp on moonlit, still nights, and sing beautiful hymns to the Almighty. And we are ready to sacrifice our lives in order to retain those hills, because those hills echoed his sweet melody and his fiery words. Because long ago, a certain girl, Sulamite of Shirashir, played hide and seek with her dad, with her beloved, in those hot valleys and cool hills. And that's why we have to sacrifice the cream of our youth in order to defend those rocky hills, hot valleys, and the cool mountain peaks. Let me ask you a simple question, and I have no answer to that question. Is it worthwhile to antagonize the Muslims all over the globe? Because we have a memory? To alienate the third world, to alienate even the Western powers? Does it pay to remain alone, because we are loyal to the Rav Zocher of 3,500 years ago? Is it logical, or is it nonsensical? I would rather say paradoxical. It is paradoxical. Let us get rid of the Rav Zocher, of the memory of the past, There's too much involved in us. Let us reconcile with the world. It's a peculiar memory. Let's forget everything, even in our lives. What's the result? Yes, no, that's okay. No, you can't do that. It's impossible. This is the answer. We also have a young child whose development and growth we watch with great concern constantly. We do believe, the Jew does believe, in the world of tomorrow. And we are immensely concerned with our continued existence as a singular spiritual community. No other nation has ever cared so much about survival. At an existential, spiritual level, as we do. The Yeretz Kunim challenges us to care for the tomorrow. No other people was as education-minded and education-oriented as the Jews. Nowhere else do you find the norm explicated in such a manner. V'shinantam levanecho, v'lemadatam esbneichem, v'yigadatam levincho, v'yaki yishoncho b'yinchamocho, kishal no yam rishenim. Somehow the child is the ambassador of the future. He represents the future. We are committed not only to a great past, but to a glorious future. We behold a great vision of a future. And we know that in order to conquer the future, one must know how to bring up, or to rear, or to educate this child. We are both. We are past-minded, past-oriented, and future-minded. Now there is one question, and let me ask you, what are you doing here now, tonight? That's what I'm doing tonight. It's a hot, or chilly, cool summer night. Somebody, enough sucking, I'm old, is addressing you. What's the purpose? What's the goal? What are you pursuing? Tell me, why did you come? I mean, you came to lose money, not to make a profit. So why did you come? I'm not serious about it. I'm not in a jocular mood now. I'm sir, why did you come? Who dragged you here? The rabbi. This is an illusion. The Rav Zokin and the Yeretz Kunim. You want to arrange a rendezvous between the Rav Zokin and the Yeretz Kunim. And if you ask me what does Judaism demand from the Jew, Ma Adeshem Malekecho Vereish Mehimoch, I'll give you one answer. Every Jew should arrange the rendezvous for a date between the Av Zokin and the Yeretz Kunim. What is Masero? What is Kabbalah? What is tradition? The oral transmission? It is just a meeting between the Av Zokin and the Yeretz Kunim. And if you ask me, what is Judaism? What does Yahadut stand for? I'll tell you what you understand for. For the meeting of youth and oldness. For the merger of the past with the future. We are just brokers. We are mediators between the past and the future. Between the Av Zokin and the Yeretz Kunim. We arrange the meetings. We arrange the dates. There is no telephone. The Av Zokin doesn't have the telephone. In these times, there was no telephone. So he needs somebody, a broker or a messenger, to arrange the rendezvous with the Yelet Skunim. That's exactly what you are doing here. Now I would like to ask you one question. What does the Rav Zaken teach the Yelet Skunim? What is he teaching? What does he tell him? He tells him, of course, the wonderful story of his life. He tells him many things. But basically, what is the central theme of their conversation? When the Yelet Skunim, the brilliant, good-looking, handsome child, meets the Rav Zaken, the patriarch, Abraham, what does he tell him? It's very hard to overhear their conversation. It's hard to eavesdrop. So unless we bug the woman with the Rav Zaken with the Yelet Skunim, but it's against the law. So we have to guess, to be imaginative and to guess. What actually do they talk to each other about? Of course, I believe the Rav Zaken does the talking, the Yelet Skunim does the listens, hearkens. What is it? And it's very strange. Believe it or not, the Yelet Skunim and the Rav Zaken understand each other very well. I believe that the Yelet Skunim, the young child, the third or the fourth generation America, when he meets the Rav Zaken, he understands it much better than we do. The Rav Zaken somehow attracts the Yelet Skunim. I have in my class, I have 100 boys, can you? I have more work, 100 boys. There are boys in my class who are already the third, fourth, fifth generation in the United States. According to the opinion of sociologists, the boy should have been completely assimilated. I marvel at them. I marvel at their devotion and their dedication to the Rav Skunim, to the old father, 3,500 years old. It's a good age, anyway. To the old father. The devotion, the commitment. It is, believe it or not, it's a miracle. We arrange, of course, the parents arrange the rendezvous, and the Rav Zaken, the date, and the Rav Zaken and the Yelet Skunim fall in love with each other. Now the question is, I would like to overhear their conversation. What does the Rav Zaken tell the Yelet Skunim? There's a lot to tell him. But what is the central theme, the topic? The central topic, what does he tell him? That attracts so beautifully the Yelet Skunim. That the Yelet Skunim, I mean, follows the Rav Zaken. I believe that the Rav Zaken teaches the Yelet Skunim two things. First, the divine, what I call, divine disciplines. I'll explain it in a minute. Second, the great divine romance. There is both. There is a normative motif in the teachings which are imparted by the Rav Zaken to the Yelet Skunim, a normative motif, there is also a romantic motif. Let me explain it to you. Moses in his farewell address to the people said the following: V'yodato im levavecho, and thou shalt consider in thy heart, ki kasher yaseir ish es bnei, ad Hashem melekecho meyasreko. As a man, I'm using here a different word, disciplines his son, so the Lord, ad Hashem melekecho meyasreko, the Lord thy God, disciplines thee. V'shomarto es mitzvah ad Hashem melekecho, v'leches bidrocho v'liro ese, and thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord, thy God, to walk in his ways, and to fear him. In other words, when you say Musa, you know, you all know the expression Musa. It's used in modern Hebrew for what? As a term designated having the connotation of ethos or morality. Musa Yadus, the ethics of Judaism. Musa basically, of course, I mean, I can write a mathematical equation. Musa equals discipline, equals morality. So in other words, that morality equals discipline. If A equals B and B equals C, so B equals C, I mean, or A equals C. So it means what the Torah teaches the Jew is to live a disciplined life. A life which follows specific rules. A life which has sequence, continuity. A life which is provided with orderliness. The main distinction, after all, Yadus fought paganism, tooth and nail. What was wrong with paganism? The main distinction between paganism and Judaism consists in the fact that while paganism preached an orgiastic, hypnotic life, it preached yielding to hedonism, to pleasure, and the freedom of enjoying whatever is enjoyable. This is basically paganism. Mother man basically is a pagan. This is basically the philosophy of mother man. To enjoy life as much as you can, as long as you can. While paganism preached orgiastic, hypnotic life, Judaism demanded sacrificial action, resignation, the capacity to resign sometimes, not from being president in the shul. I don't know who the president is and whether he intends to resign. To resign from something which is very tempting and very attractive and beautiful. Resign from something for which all I have to do in order to get it is to reach out. Just reach out for it, and I have it within my grip, the capacity to resign. That's what Judaism asked from the Jew. According to Yahadus, humanitas means man, in contradistinction to the brute, expresses to brutishness, expresses itself in a disciplined existence. As a matter of fact, this is the acid test of man, and whoever can discipline himself is a human being. Whoever yields to pressure is a brute. We know from the story about the tree of knowledge. What was the first test? What did the first test of man consist? exercise his freedom to resign, or he will exercise his freedom to enjoy. Had Eve acted differently, had she exercised her freedom to resign, the destiny of the human race would have been a different one, you know that very well. Unfortunately, she failed the test. To enjoy, not to resign. And I want to add something which perhaps does not belong to my topic, but it's very important to emphasize it. Yehadus was particularly concerned with disciplined action in an area where the orgiastic pull is the strongest, namely in that of sex morality. If Yehadis had been strict, it was strict in this area. Undisciplined, arrogant activity in that area leads to defilement of the human personality. Disciplined behavior and modesty, on the contrary, leads to Kedusha, to sanctity. That's exactly what the first kind of disciplined life which the Rav Zokin teaches the young child. He teaches him discipline, disciplined action, the capacity to resign, even though the man is challenged by Hedonai. This is what I call discipline in one's carnal activities, in his activities as a flesh, as a body. After all, we are physiologically, we resemble physiologically the animal. There isn't much difference physiologically or biologically between the animal and the man. And the Torah told man, of course he can discharge physiological pressures, but in a disciplined manner. This is the first foundation of Yehadus. To discharge or to release biological pressure, be it in the area of food, be it in the area of sex or life, be it in other areas, with dignity and modesty. This means to discipline oneself or to possess this wonderful capability of resigning at a time when temptation is overwhelming. And orgiastic life is within my reach. This is disciplined action number one. There is disciplined action number two, which the Rav of Zokin teaches the young child. Disciplined action is required by Yehadus in another area. And beside the carnal area of carnal activities, namely with regard to human relations. There are tens or perhaps hundreds of precepts which are concerned not with the relations between men and his body, but between man and his neighbor, fellow man, or what we call it in the vernacular, social morality, or in our halachic jargon, we call it mitzvah shebenodom lachaveri, mitzvahs which are related to the contact between man and his fellow man. While disciplined, carnal action leads to kedusha, disciplined social action leads to honesty, to emes, to chesed, to dignity. Or disciplined social action commands respect of the non-Jew. And I believe that the Rav Zocken teaches the child not only about Shabbos, not only about treifas and kashrus, not only about sex morality, so all those things are very important. They are the cornerstones of our tradition. But he also teaches him about relationships between him and society. And those teachings are just as important as the teachings pertaining to Binyan Avraham Hakohen. And I believe that the question, as a matter of fact, Rabbi Shlomo Salanter said so, the question whether I am entitled to a profit which is offered to me is just as important as the inquiry whether the chicken is treif and kosher. Rabbi Shlomo Salanter used to say, we know that the chicken can be treif or kosher. But it's a mistake. Not only the chicken is sometimes treif, the dollar is also sometimes treif or sometimes kosher. And it is incumbent upon all these schools, elementary grades, or higher grades, I don't care, that not only Bitzvei Shebenotam Lamokim should be ingrained and implanted in the child, but also Mitzvei Shebenotam Lachaveh. When I hear, for instance, that a child from Yeshiva was cheating at an exam, I feel sorry for ourselves. We have failed. We could not teach the child not to cheat the next exam. When I see a child from Yeshiva behaving without dignity, arrogantly, I am sick at heart. It's our failure, it's not his failure. And the traditional community, the Orthodox community, should certainly be careful as far as the observance of the social mitzvahs are concerned, because we will exist or we will disappear. We will exist if we will command dignity by practicing charity and honesty, particularly honesty and truthfulness, and we will lose the battle if we will employ certain methods which are below the dignity of any Jew. I must say, recent history is not very encouraging. There is a third kind of discipline which Yehad the Rav Zocken teaches the young child, and the child hearkens and listens carefully. Namely, a disciplined inner life. The Torah is interested not only in human physical actions, be it at the individual physiological level, like eating, be it at a social level, such as selling or manufacturing goods, but the Torah is also interested in the inner activities of the Jew, in his emotional life. There is very much interest. We don't know, it's a secret. You look at me as if I were talking about, I mean, some nonsense. We think that the Torah is only concerned with the hand, with the legs, with my mouth, with the digestive organs. Truly, there is concern. But there is also concern with my feelings, with my sentiments, with my emotions. And the Torah knew very well that certain emotions which I experience, such as hate, envy, are disjunctive, and the Torah requires of me to disown such emotions, to disown, to reject them. We believe in freedom of man, not only to perform physical acts, but also, I mean, as far as inner life is concerned. If an emotion is destructive, disjunctive, so I am capable, that the Torah believes, that man is capable to disown it, to reject it, to get it out of his system, of his spiritual personality. I can give you an example. I mean, I'm not bragging about myself, but I cannot draw on the experience of somebody else. I have to draw on my own experience. I was very envious as a child. Very envious. I was envious of my friends because I was not a bright child. It's true. Some call me stupid. I was honest, intellectually honest. But I was not bright. I was very envious. Out of that, Itzik, the faker. I was terribly honest. Envious. And I remember my father called me once and said, it is a middle miguna. It's a better habit. The emotion of envy is lisachmet, lisachmet, the terror is forbidden. And I began to train myself to overcome it, and I have succeeded. Now there is no kine, no envy in my heart. I mean, I'm bad enough, boy. But there is no envy in my heart. On the contrary, I rejoice with the success of my fellow man. The Torah demanded for man a disciplined inner life. On the contrary, we know of constructive, cathartic emotions, such as sympathy, such as love, such as gratitude, which should be integrated in one's personality. One has freedom not only to control his physical acts, but to control his emotional life. And this kind of discipline of the inner life is also taught by the Arov Zokin of the Old Father to the Yeletz Kunim, to the intelligent, bright, talented Jewish child. Jewish children are very talented. So we have three disciplines. There is a fourth discipline, which is also important. There is another kind of disciplined action which is fundamental in Yahadus, namely disciplined thought. I feel like mentioning it because this throws a light upon our day schools, particularly the high schools, where the child is trained, what we call in Gemore, in Tirosh Baal Peh, or let me use the jargon, Lomdes. You know what Lomdes is, or Lamdanut there, I mean, you know. Because halacha is not just a book of rules. You're making a mistake if you identify halacha with the kitzur shulchan aruch. It's not just a book of rules. Don't, you shall not. It is a book of rules, but it's more than that. also a system of thought, a unique method of approaching and interpreting the world what is colloquially known as Landes is an intellectual frame of reference, a unique way of thinking. Halacha is universal. It interprets every phenomenon and every event. We have categories, we have concepts, we have methods of our own. And let me tell you something, I am pretty well conversant with this philosophical analysis, the most modern philosophical analysis. And I can tell you, and I'm not speaking in an apologetic manner, because I don't like to apologize, and I've never engaged in apologetics. I don't defend the others. I think that I should be aggressive, not on the defensive. Yeah. But the way we have developed, the yeshivas, developed our methodology as far as definition, defining, or abstraction, or classifying, or demonstrating, or postulating, are concerned, we are not behind the most modern philosophical analysis. We are ahead of them. Our instruments of thought are by far more precise and finer than the instruments of thought, what shall I say, of John Dewey or William James. And again, it's not an apology. And the Rav Zokein teaches the Yoled Zkunim how to act, how to think, how to discipline their thoughts. And this kind of training, this is our problem, because we have to devote a lot of time to that kind of training. This is the problem that we call it Gemara. What is teaching Gemara? It's not a reading, of course, you've got to know how to read. If you don't know how to read, you cannot understand the content. What do you do when you teach Gemara or Torah Shabbat Peh? What do you do? What is your purpose, your objective? What do you want to achieve? What do you want to attain? And you know very well, I don't know how many hours you give to Gemara in the high school which you found it. Well, how many
hours?
Huh?
3 hours.
3 hours a day, I mean. How much time do you give to math?
An hour a day.
An hour a day, right? And how much do you give to history?
No,
but why 3 hours? Going don't understand it. Because we are not teaching just a text. We teach the child how to think halakhically. We are teaching a method. We are teaching an approach. We are teaching analysis. We are teaching the art of conceptualizing, of defining, of classifying, of inferring. And this takes time. Years ago, for instance, when I started mathematics, so basically in the elementary schools and even the high school, they didn't teach mathematics. Oh no. They taught some calculation technique, how to figure, how to add, how to subtract, how to multiply. It was a technique. It was not a science, it was not a discipline, it was a technique. Now, I mean, with the reforms introduced in the education of the field of mathematics, they already in the grade school, they start teaching the child concepts, to conceptualize, not to figure out, not to calculate, not to count, but to understand, to conceptualize, to abstract, to classify. That's exactly our job, is the teaching of the mind. And the Rav Zokein, if you give him time, he has enough money. He has enough money to support the institution. So the Rav Zokein teaches the child not only discipline as far as his carnal activities are concerned, like eating, loving, and so forth, not only discipline as far as his social activities are concerned, not only discipline as far as his inner life is concerned, to dissolve disjunctive emotions and to assimilate and integrate into himself only noble emotions, but also it teaches him discipline of thought. It's very important. That's why I call it yeshiva. However, those are the disciplines which the Rav Zocken teaches the Yeret Zkunim. And I want to tell you, as far as Lomdes is concerned, American Jewish children are very bright and brilliant. And sometimes I don't believe my own eyes. Their accomplishments are fantastic. I am speaking from experience, because I've been a Melamed of Gemara all my life. However, there is, besides discipline, which the Rav Zocken teaches the Yeret Zkunim, the Rav Zocken teaches the Yeret Zkunim something else. And this is the romanticism of Yehadus, or the romance of Yehadus. Yehadus is not only discipline. We start with discipline, yes. With discipline in the child. In all, at all levels, at the karma level, the social level, at the emotional level, and at the intellectual level. Yeah. But do you conclude with teaching the child something which my Malamed taught me, how to experience Yahadus, how to feel Yahadus. A Jew is supposed not only to know what Yahadus stands for, to possess knowledge of Yahadus. He's called upon to experience Yahadus, to live Yahadus. Somehow that Yahadus should have, to engage in a romance with the Almighty, with God. Yahadus is a norm to be implemented by action. It is a concept to be analyzed and understood by my intellect. It also remains to be experienced, to be lived, and to be enjoyed. It's a great drama to be acted out, as well to be watched. The study of Torah Sheba'al Peh, the compliance with its precepts, is perhaps the greatest of all hedonic pursuits. I believe this is the greatest pleasure, is to study the Torah and to delve into its depth. The whole world, a new world appears, new horizons. And then somehow, you enjoy it. It is perhaps, to study Yahadus and to live like a Jew, is perhaps the most exciting of our adventures, and the most purging, and the most cleansing and cathartic of all preoccupations. The Rav Zocken teaches the Yeret Zkunim not only how to act, but also how to experience Yahadus. How to feel and how to live Yahadus. Let me make an admission here. I'll confide in you. This is the toughest of all jobs, of all tasks. I know from my own experience how difficult it is. I am, as I told you at the very beginning, and I am not modest, I'm very far from being modest. I am a good teacher. I can teach halacha. I can explain the most abstract concepts. I can popularize the most complex Talmudic debate and break it down into its component parts. I can explain and elucidate abstract ideas. For instance, I don't do that anymore because whatever I'm going to say, my Talmidim may know. So I can't help it. But I used to do it quite often, before Rosh Hashanah, before Yom Kippurim. I used to study with my boys, I mean, your rabbi will confirm it. The halacha pertaining to those days of awe. From time to time, I can reach out for the Agada, for a philosophical, for philosophical concepts which elucidate the philosophy of those solemn festivals. If necessary, I can introduce a modern idiom in order to explain certain aspects of the Kedushas Hayom. All those tricks I know, but one trick I can't master. However, one thing I cannot do with perfection, namely to tell my students how I felt on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippurim when I was their age. How I felt about it. Not what I know about it. I know a lot and they know a lot. But how I felt about it. How I experienced it. How I lived it. I'm unable to tell them what I experienced. For instance, when the Shliach Tzibur used to chant, sing, V'akeini V'Rom Ha'imdim Ba'Azore. If you know the melody, there's so much nostalgia. There's so much longing. There's so much melancholy in that tune, that Nusach, V'akeini V'Rom Ha'imdim Ba'Azore. I felt as if I had been transferred in time and space into a different world. But how can I explain to my Talmidim, to my disciples, to my students? I can tell it to them, but I cannot pass on my experience to them. Or what I felt, you keep a night, when the congregation responded, Amen, following the chanting of Shehiyonu, to transfer experiences, not concepts, to pass on feelings, not numbers, to tell the story of both inner restlessness and serenity, to tell the story of joy and awe, of trepidation and at the same time certitude in one's heart, one must use not words cannot explain it. But a funny medium, silence, that Muhammad of all knew how to pass on his experiences, his ecstatic experiences, his mystical outlook on life to his pupils without saying a single word. Of course, those experiences can be passed on. You know how do you pass on a disease? How do you pass on? Through words? If I should have scarlet fever, I may talk to you, I mean, for 5 hours you wouldn't catch the disease. How can I communicate a disease? Well, how? Through contact. And that's exactly the art of somehow communing with the soul of the person, not through the word, but through silence, to be one in silence. However, it's very difficult. I haven't succeeded. I hope that your teachers in the new high school will succeed in this area where I failed miserably. And I give them my blessings. And I must say that you are doing something very great We are arranging for a rendezvous between the Ovzok and the Dialect Skunim. In a nice environment, say in a beautiful building, we both deserve recognition and appreciation. And I hope that you will respond to it with enthusiasm and ecstasy. In conclusion, I beg your pardon or your permission to say, to make the following few remarks. And I want to tell you, I have many faults, but flattery is not among my faults. I cannot flatter anybody. Panegyric flattery, I hate. I hated panegyric and flattery as a child, I still hate it. However, while panegyric and flattery are forbidden, telling the truth was hailed by our rabbis as morally worthwhile and commendable. One should say words of limited praise in the presence of the person who is being praised. God did so. It's not a permission, it's a duty, an obligation to do so. The Almighty did so. He told Noach, "Keischor isi tzadik bador hazeh." Why is it necessary to tell a person not everything you think, not his whole praise, but a part of what he deserves? Why is it necessary? Why not tell him at all? Why not tell him anything? There's no need for it. The answer is very simple. Quite often, Noach said to himself, you know, Noach was the only one who was engaged in constructing the ark. Quite often he said to himself, no one cares, no one is interested in saving the world. And this goal, no one shares in the burden of constructing the ark. I am alone, what can an individual accept? I mean accomplish. The Almighty told him, Noach, you are mistaken. I recognize and appreciate your work, your devotion, your zeal, and your accomplishment. Don't be discouraged. You will emerge victorious from your engagement with indifference and carelessness. You will be considered later as the architect of the world. Similar remarks I wish to address to our friend, Mr. Max Stern, and I am sincere what I am saying, who brought me here tonight. He brought me here tonight. Rabbi Riskin helped. But he did the job. I know that from time to time, Mr. Stern never confided to me, but I guess that from time to time, Mr. Stern asks himself the same question. Does anyone care for the world, for the Torah world of tomorrow? For the preservation of our spiritual identity, for the Avzokin and the Yeletzkunim? Does anyone make an effort to introduce the Yeletzkunim to the Avzokin and to arrange a rendezvous between them, bringing them together? I know the questions which come up in Mr. Stern's mind When he returns home sometimes from a meeting, I know meetings can be very frustrating, not constructive. People give advice, but they don't want to share in the burden. And I know what Mr. Stern asks himself on a sleepless night. Is it worthwhile? Let me tell him the word which the Almighty told Noah. We know, we appreciate your efforts. You actually, I mean, the school, the Manhattan Day School, the great school, which is very important. Don't forget the great school while you are busy, engaged in building a high school, because the feeder is the great school, the great school. But without Mr. Stern, there would be no great school, that's what I was told, certainly no high school. And we do care about it. We do appreciate your efforts. And we are very thankful to you for that. And I believe that the audience will join me in extending our best wishes to Mr. Stern for a very long, long life, for many years of constructive, creative work, replete with chesed, sweet and fantasy.